The 65-year-old director Michael Haneke was born in Germany and raised in Austria, the setting of many of his violent and controversial films. In 2005, he had his biggest international hit, the French-language Cachet. His new English-language film, Funny Games, stars Naomi Watts and Tim Roth and is a remake of his own 1997 Austrian thriller. Critic David Edelstein has this review.
2 years ago, I was the butt of Michael Haneke's sick joke. The folks at Kino Video sent me a package of the German director's pre-Cachet features, among them Funny Games, which Haneke has now remade with Naomi Watts and Tim Roth. The original is the tale of a well-to-do Austrian family, a mom, a dad, a little son, whose vacation home is invaded by two courteous young men in white preppy duds, who for no apparent reason go on to torture them. I watched to the end, removed the DVD, and snapped it over my knee. It hit me later that my response would have delighted Haneke. Here was proof he'd succeeded in shocking the bourgeoisie. I can't say whether the American Funny Games is a frame-by-frame remake of the original, because, of course, I broke the DVD. But the changes are minimal. Here are the same elegant tableaus, the same impassive camera, the same creepy-crawly flatness. Michael Pitt and Brady Corbett now play Paul and Peter, who move from gated compound to gated compound, introducing themselves with a polite request on behalf of a neighbor for eggs, dropping them by accident and asking for more. When Naomi Watts' Anne tells Michael Pitt's Paul to leave, he feigns total incredulity.
Listen, young man, I don't know what kind of game you're playing, but I don't want to be a part of it. Would you please leave now?
What game? I'm sorry, ma'am, but I don't understand why you're suddenly being so unfriendly. Did Tom or I do anything to upset you?
Please leave.
Did you misbehave while I was outside? Was he rude? Did he say something that...
Stop it! I've asked you nicely to leave. Now, I'd like you to go.
Well, I don't understand what's upset you, but if you insist, just give Tom the eggs and we won't bother you anymore.
Naomi Watts produced this remake, apparently concluding she hadn't yet been sufficiently violated on screen. King Kong, after all, turned out to be a softie. Now she's hopped into the hairy paw of a giant ape artiste. And this ape has postmodern pretensions, so Paul occasionally turns to the camera and winks at the audience. The campiness, surprisingly, doesn't take the edge off what we're watching. The suffering of the mother, father, and child is hideously realistic. And our thoughts turn not to the picture's artifice, but to the line of cinematic killers in the last few decades who videotaped their atrocities. One is the title character in Haneke's early Benny's Video, a media-deadened 12-year-old who repeatedly watches a tape of a pig being slaughtered, then tries out the pig-killing gun on an adolescent girl, in a scene that would appall even No Country for Old Men's Anton Chigurh. Benny was played by Arno Frisch, who grew up to be one of the home invaders in the original Funny Games, and the link is significant. Benny's Video was part of what Haneke called his glaciation trilogy, in which he indicted the people of Austria for their callousness toward the carnage in nearby Bosnia. Later, in Cachet, he used a mysterious videotape as a means of punishing a Frenchman for repressing his country's crimes against Algerian immigrants. The sociopaths of Funny Games are monstrous, but the director also seems to be mocking the American family they ravage for its privileged obliviousness. I say seems to be because it's difficult to grapple with serious themes when what comes through most vividly is the director's sadism. In the end, Funny Games is little more than high-toned torture porn, with an edge of righteousness that's not unlike Peter and Paul's. audiences flock to nightmarish home invasion thrillers because of an implicit pact with the filmmakers that the invaders will be vanquished and the family unit saved. Some could make the case that Haneke deserves a measure of respect for reminding us how pathetically dependent we are on that pact and its cathartic endings. But I won't, because the movie is shallow and itself glacially unengaged, a punkish assault without punk's redeeming passion. There I go again, metaphorically snapping funny games over my knee. I bet that tickles Haneke. That's the thing about vapid provocateurs. No matter how wretched their work, they think the joke is always on us.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Back now with Day to Day. With the weekend before St. Patrick's Day upon us, let's see if there are any box office pot of gold contenders among the new movie releases. To tell us what the critics think of some of these films, here's Mark Jordan Legan with Slate's summary judgment.
For those of you adapting to daylight saving time and still feeling a bit off, you may want to stay far away from the psychological horror Funny Games. An American remake by the original director of the same-titled harrowing Austrian film, Michael Haneke uses Naomi Watts and Tim Roth as the husband and wife who are terrorized at their vacation home by two disturbed young men.
Listen, young man, I don't know what kind of game you're playing, but I don't want to be a part of it. Would you please leave now?
I'm sorry, ma'am, but I don't understand why you're suddenly being so unfriendly.
I've asked you nicely to leave. Now, I'd like you to go.
Many critics felt pummeled by this brutal thriller. USA Today speaks for many of the detractors, calling it sadistic and disturbing, easily the toughest movie to sit through since Natural Born Killers. But Newsday finds Funny Games expertly written and executed, and Entertainment Weekly applauds the terrific acting, but wonders, can a movie be gripping and repellent at the same time? Well, gee, sounds like a nice night out. Speaking of a nice night out, how about the apocalyptic action drama Doomsday? An elite group of specialists try and battle a deadly virus that has forced a futuristic society to quarantine an entire country. Bob Hoskins and Malcolm McDowell star.
What we've built here from the ashes is pure blood, uninfected by the outside world, until now.
Have you found the cure?
There is no cure. There never was.
Maybe the virus is caused by overacting, or bad reviews, or lack thereof. Yes, how can you expect there to be an advanced screening for critics when the whole country is quarantined? Okay, so no suburban psychopaths or road warrior wannabes for you. How about a sweet and funny family film? Yes, the big screen computer animated version of Horton Hears a Who is opening in wide release, with Jim Carrey as Horton and Steve Carell just one of the big stars providing voice talent.
Hey, hon, did you ever get the feeling that you were being watched? And that maybe that thing watching you is, a giant elephant?
You know, I'm gonna have to say no.
The nation's critics were charmed by Horton. The Charlotte Observer cheers witty and whimsical. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer says it's a loving and attentive take on a charming classic. And the Hollywood Reporter trumpets, Horton Hears a Who is a delight, brimming with bountiful wit. You know, I've also heard that they've recently uncovered Dr. Seuss's lost sequel, Horton Hears the Who, where the innocent elephant is taken to his first rock concert and constantly badgered with down in front. The movie version with the Who will probably never happen, though. I hear Pete Townsend can't stand Horton and that the mayor of Whoville's wife ran off with Roger Daltrey.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer in Los Angeles who destroys one ukulele a week when he performs alone on his back porch.
On Fridays, we talk about your money. Today, we talk about your money if you're in the same class of Americans as Jamie Johnson. His family founded the giant corporation Johnson & Johnson. He grew up amid money and privilege. Now he uses his insider status to make documentaries that are critical of the rich. Johnson's latest is called The 1%. It's airing on Cinemax this month. NPR's Jim Zaroli has this story.
In the world where Jamie Johnson grew up, there was an inviolable rule. You never discussed money.
I remember bringing it up with my family, and I remember my father saying, Jamie, why are you talking to me about this? If anyone asks you about it, tell them you're not related to the family that started Johnson & Johnson.
Really? Why do you think he said that?
You know, you see wealthy people across the board being reluctant to talk about wealth often, particularly in these old money, waspy American families. It's even more of a taboo subject.
A taboo that Johnson, at least, isn't afraid to violate. His first documentary was about the children of the rich. His latest is about the growing concentration of wealth among families like his own.
Our family's fortune is growing faster than ever. We're part of a small number of American families that own most of the country's wealth. But having so much in the hands of so few can't be good for America.
Johnson describes a world where the super rich attend conferences to learn ways to avoid inheritance taxes, where sugar barons buy access to presidents. The film has its obvious side. Johnson likes to juxtapose scenes of deprivation, like New Orleans after Katrina, with glimpses of country clubs and mansions. He interviews commentators like Ralph Nader, Kevin Phillips, and Robert Reich, all making familiar points. But Johnson has a youthful passion for his subject. In one scene, the lanky, earnest 26-year-old spars with the late economist Milton Friedman, then 88.
When our society collapses, it will be not be for the reasons you've cited. It will be because our government has grown too big. because we have not held government down to size.
I'm nervous that because we're not asking the right questions, because we're not willing to curtail our rapid growth, because the people...
I think it's time for you to get out of here.
We're at the stage now where the gap between the rich and poor is growing.
You've exhausted my patience.
I have.
The 1% is also a family drama, part Eugene O'Neill and part Michael Moore. Johnson follows his own father around trying to interview him. He wears a hidden microphone and sneaks into a private club in Florida that requires members to wear white on the croquet court. At one point, a family financial advisor tells him off.
You say, okay, fine, I'll go do my homework, and you don't. I don't need it. It's a pain in the ass. You're behaving like a little arrogant trustafarian.
One of the interesting things in the documentary is that you sort of pursue your father at various points. What did you want him to talk to you about?
Well, I felt that in some way he recognized that there was value in my making the 1%, and to try and deny the money that you have and trying to, you know, deny the fact that you live an affluent lifestyle really is nonsensical, completely irrational. And I was hoping to get him to communicate that.
In the course of the movie, Johnson learns his father once financed a documentary about apartheid. His father reluctantly agrees to talk about it. He says after the film aired on public TV, he was chewed out by Johnson & Johnson's CEO. It seemed the company did business in South Africa. Then he clams up again.
I can't give you solutions for the world.
Johnson says his relationship with his father is strained because of the film, and old friends have disapproved of the way he takes a battering ram into the world where he grew up. But Johnson says the refusal of the rich to talk about their privileges is one reason acknowledging the wealth gap has been so hard.
Certainly without raising these questions and without forcing the most powerful and influential people in our country to consider the problem and to think about solving it, you're certainly not going to get anywhere.
By using his own background, Johnson is able to pierce the wealth bubble and focus a little more attention on what's happening. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
And now, one side of a national issue is using a new movie to rally its cause.
I meant what I said, and I said what I meant. And an elephant's faithful, 100%.
Okay, that's one of Horton the Elephant's best-known mottos, as voiced by Jim Carrey in the animated version of Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. But another Horton saying has drawn attention from anti-abortion groups. They see a message in the movie that suits their purpose, as NPR's Kim Masters reports.
In Horton Hears a Who, Horton the Elephant discovers that there's a whole town on a tiny speck that has floated his way.
I don't exactly know how to tell you this, but
you're living on a speck.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, oh voice from the drainpipe, but I live in Whoville.
Despite skeptics on all sides, Horton is determined to protect life on the speck. A person's a person, no matter how small, he declares. When Horton said that line during the Los Angeles premiere of the film last Saturday, demonstrators who had slipped into the theater started to yell.
I thought maybe there was a nut loose in the theater or something.
That's Carl Zobel, an attorney who has represented the interests of Dr. Seuss, or Theodore Geisel, for some 40 years. After the show, Zobel saw the demonstrators handing out anti-abortion flyers that looked like movie tickets. Geisel's widow, Audrey, was there, and Zobel says none of this sat well with her.
She doesn't like people to hijack Dr. Seuss characters or material to front their own points of view.
Some anti-abortion websites say Audrey Geisel supports Planned Parenthood. Zobel says he never discussed such matters with her or her late husband, but he says the Geisels never wanted Dr. Seuss characters used for any political purpose.
People running for office like to refer to their opponent as the Grinch because it's kind of a simple-minded way to say, my opponent is a mean, bad person.
In Colorado, Christy Burton represents a group working on a ballot initiative stating that life begins at conception. She says her group wasn't at the film's premiere, but is planning to show up at Denver theaters when the movie opens, not in protest, but in support of its message. That may not have pleased Dr. Seuss, but she says the group has been careful not to go too far in using his material.
Regardless of anyone's particular position, the statement, a person is a person no matter how small, certainly affirms our amendment in defining a person from the very beginning stages.
Burton says the group has no plans to disrupt the movie. They'll simply wear T-shirts bearing that Horton motto and try to gather signatures for their petition. Kim Masters, NPR News.
You know, it's been a long week. We need to turn our brains off and get entertained. So we're going to the movies. We just got to make it through a little more radio show first. Daniel Holloway is here to help me do that. Film critic for the Metro newspaper. Hi, Daniel.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm an Irish lush.
You are?
No, I'm not. I guess I am. My last name's Holloway.
You should be. Do you like Guinness?
I like Guinness.
Yeah, me too. Okay, anyway, we digress. We'll drink Guinness later. But first, we're going to talk about movies. Let's start with Funny Games.
We have to?
Yeah, we're going to. The trailer for this, I've seen it. It's freakish. Michael Haneke has made this movie before, apparently in Austria in 97.
Yeah.
Why is he making the same movie again?
The movie's so nice, he made it twice. That's a really good question. I was.
Thanks.
In fact, it was on you guys' blog the other day. There was a posting about this that Ian pointed out to me. And it was funny because it mentioned a review that was like, what could his motivation possibly be for making a shot-for-shot remake of a movie he made?
Is it really that
11
identical?
Years ago. Yeah, yeah. Huh. Shot-for-shot remake. I must confess, I haven't seen the first one, but this is like, this is what I've heard.
Uh-huh.
I don't know beyond money or, you know, the glory of being proclaimed.
Was the
most
first one released in the U.S.?
Ever. No, it was a German film. It was a German film. I'm sorry. So, yeah, it's a shot-for-shot remake of a German film that he made in 1997. This time around, it stars Naomi Watts and Tim Roth, Michael Pitt, Brady Corbett. And it's the most horrifying thing you'll see at the movies this year, and that's not really a good thing.
Ooh, interesting. Okay, let's hear a little bit of it. This is a scene. Here's Tim Roth and Naomi Watts being taunted by these young men.
Okay. We bet, what time is it?
8:40.
That in, let's say, 12 hours, all three of you are going to be kaput. Okay?
What?
You bet that you'll be alive tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and we bet that you'll be dead. Okay?
They don't want a bet.
Well, it's not an option. There has to be a bet. I mean, what do you think? You think they stand a chance? You're on their side, aren't you? Who are you betting on, hmm?
But, wait, what kind of bet is this? If they're dead, they can't live up to their side. And if they win, they can't live either.
Yes, they'll lose either way. That's what I'm saying.
Ugh. So we should say, set this up a little bit. This family's been taken hostage by these two twins? Are they twins?
They're not twins. They're just made to creepily look alike. there are two guys wearing white golf shirts and white gloves. And they just happen to show up about 10, 15 minutes into the movie. And from that moment on, you have a hostage situation. There's a little bit of psychological play near the beginning that could be kind of interesting. But the movie quickly digresses into what David Edelstein called torture porn. This is torture Ooh. Porn disguised as art. It's not Hostel. It's not Saw. But it's basically the same premise. The only difference is that in this film, the violence is always obscured by a sofa or it happens just off camera.
Huh.
But the emotional violence is still just as disturbing, and it's not done in a way that is intriguing or engaging. And as we just heard in the clip there, when that was Michael Pitt's character speaking, at one point he goes, oh, well, who are you betting on? He's actually turning and speaking to the camera right then. And it's adding insult to injury because, you know, most American movie audiences walk into a movie with certain expectations, and sometimes they're not the most sophisticated expectations, but...
You don't think the audience buys that?
He's taunting the audience for wanting, you know, a plot or a plausible ending. And it's when you're being this abused as an audience because you're basically – it's nonstop torment that you're watching with no narrative arc whatsoever. You don't want to be made fun of for being uncomfortable while you're watching this
stuff. Okay, there you have it. Clearly
– It's a winner. It's the must-see film of 2008.
Top of my list for the weekend to make you feel good. Feel-good film, really. Okay, let's move on. Sleepwalking. Charlize Theron, Dennis Hopper, Nick Stahl, Woody Harrelson. Sounds like a good cast.
Yeah, if those first three were in it more.
Okay, the trailer describes a movie like this. Jolene is a woman stuck in yesterday. James is a man who can't imagine tomorrow. Tara, a child trapped in between. before I ask you what that means, let's listen to a clip. Here's Nick Stahl and Anna Sophia Robb talking in a diner.
We could go to Mexico. Isn't that where you go in this sort of situation?
Mexico?
Yeah, like in the movies.
I don't think we have enough to get that far.
Well, we need fake names. You know, so we don't get caught. I'll be Nicole, and I want to be 13 years old. Because being 12 is stupid.
I don't get it.
I didn't get it either, and I saw it. I don't know. It's just a really boring movie. I made the mistake of not writing the review right after seeing it, and 2 days later, I was just struggling to remember what even happened in this film. It's just, you know, Charlize Theron's character is there in the beginning. I don't know what that means. She's trapped in yesterday. He can't imagine tomorrow. Blah blah blah. I have no idea. Basically, she's like, you know, just this kind of hard living woman, and she ends up abandoning her daughter for a short period. The daughter falls into child services. The brother ends up taking the daughter, and they hit the road together because he doesn't want her to be in child services anymore. And it takes a movie. It feels like it takes it 3 hours just to get there. It just plods along, and nothing. These characters never do anything for most of the film. It's just stuff happening to them, and it's the most boring stuff in the world.
Okay, so we've got torture porn.
Yeah,
we've got the most boring movie in the world.
Yep.
Let's move on to something. I hope it's going to elicit a more positive response.
It will.
You. It will.
I promise.
Awesome. Horton Hears a Who. Who yes. can't love that? A computer animated adaptation of the Dr. Seuss classic. Okay, so everybody know, if you grew up with Dr. Seuss, you know this story. Now, does this film live up to that? Does it capture the Dr. Seuss-ness, the magic of Seuss?
Visually, it's incredible. The guys at Blue Sky made this. Blue Sky is like a poor man's Pixar. They're the folks who made Ice Age. Visually, Seuss translates very, very well into the modern like 3D animation that's being done right now. Surprisingly well. There's an extraordinary scene with Horton the elephant at the beginning where he's walking along and you see this sort of elephant lumbering through the jungle. Very kind of standard thing when you see elephants in movies. He headbutts a tree. The tree bends over. It looks like he's going to uproot it. He walks along. Is, you know, he just looks like any normal elephant, no expression on his face. And then he gets to the end of the tree, and instead of it looks like he's crossing this little creek, he stands up and jumps up in the air and does a swan dive. And I swear, it's like, it's so good. It's just the most beautiful thing. It looks like it came out of like, yeah, a Tex Avery cartoon. It's
That's
fantastic.
That's awesome. I do, before we let you go, I do want to hear this clip. Can we play it?
I don't exactly know how to tell you this, but
you're living on a speck.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, oh voice from the drainpipe, but I live in Whoville.
Well, then, Whoville's a speck.
Right, okay, seriously, who is this? Is this Bert from accounting?
No. This is Horton. I'm an elephant.
Awesome. That was Horton, voiced by Jim Carrey, talking to the mayor of Whoville, Steve Carell. Can't really lose with those two, right?
Nah, it's good.
Awesome. Daniel Holloway, magical as always to be with you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Film critic for The Metro. And we'll talk to you next week, I imagine.
Yes, ma'am.
Now for a movie review. The Unforeseen is a little documentary with some powerful friends. Robert Redford and Terrence Malick are executive producers. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has this look at it.
The Unforeseen unfolds like a tragic whodunit, with the Earth itself being the victim of the crime. This documentary skirts the danger of being a tree-hugger movie. Instead, it honors the intricacies of a complex subject, a 30-year war between developers and environmentalists around Austin, Texas. It turns that into a microcosm for land use issues everywhere. We hear first from a soft-spoken man who talks of the harshness that made him abandon rural life.
Nature, very quickly in your life as a child, becomes God. A God that gives them great abundance at times and takes everything away at times.
That man is known as the most controversial real estate developer in Central Texas, Gary Bradley. The Unforeseen shows what happens when one of his projects threatens Barton Springs, a beloved spring-fed swimming area. That led first to an Austin environmental movement that helped stop growth, and then to a property rights backlash that helped put George Bush into the governor's mansion and eventually into the White House. What then and now footage starkly reveals is that everyone's worst fears about development near Barton Springs came to pass.
So instead of having a healthy stream, you now have a drainage ditch that's either bone dry and largely dead, or it's a raging, you know, flood channel. And so instead of having this healthy stream, you know, you have these boom and bust cycles that are really destroy the stream ecology.
The Unforeseen's refusal to demonize Bradley is one of its strengths. Yet no one who sees this intriguing documentary will want to argue with a reporter who insists near the end, we need a more mature regard for the future. We do indeed.
The documentary is The Unforeseen. Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times.